Clarion Call, Part 7. Griffin and Raven formed the point of a flying wedge of duelists, Space Force reservists, and other dangerous types as they all swept up the corridor leading to the IPO staging area. "Talk to me," he said, so preoccupied with what he was trying to pull together that he was holding his half of a lens conversation out loud. "What have we got?" "What? That... no, that's not good enough. Damn it, I've had this conversation with... oh, really? No. No, you tell Kimball if he doesn't pull his thumb out in the next 45 seconds, I'll find someone who will." A few paces behind, Utina shrugged into her uniform jacket on the move and said to anyone who cared to answer, "What are we bringing to this party? Anyone have any idea?" "Kurotai stands ready," said Liza Shustal at once. "We fought for Tau Ceti once, and we will do it again." "Garen," said Amanda Dessler into a hand communicator, "drop whatever you were doing and set course for the Tau Ceti system immediately. Yes, it's an Imperial command if it'll make your paperwork simpler." "My people won't be much use in a space battle," Mitsuru Tsuwabuki offered, "but you know we're willing to help on the ground if you can get us there."
"Ah, Kabaripomen Takara,"
Tunser declared. "Count us in," Jaima Candless added.
"And us," said the Master Chief.
"I am with you, Captain Tenjo,"
Shan Bastila chimed in.
"You know I'm in, and..."
"No," Utina reminded herself, must use her new Jedi Master name now, Aten Vey Springsteen said with a grin.
"Spark, get down to the train and crank her up," Chad Collier ordered.
"Chad?" said a voice from the cluster of duelists who'd come from Gerardo.
"Oh, wow! Hi!"
Chad whipped around to look so fast he nearly fell over, since he was still striding briskly down the corridor in pace with the rest of them.
"Ezri?"
Grinning broadly, Ezri Teagan detached herself from the pack and gave him a hug, as best she could, given his huge height advantage and the fact that they were both still trying to keep up with the rest.
"You're in Starfleet now?"
Chad asked, noting her uniform. Ezri nodded.
"Third year at the Academy," she said.
"What are you doing?" But for the fur, all the color would have drained from Chad's face. He looked furtively around the corridor and blurted,
"Oh God, he's not here, is he?"
Ezri looked puzzled.
"What?
Oh no," she said, laughing. "I'm here with the duelist crew from Gerardo. I'm... well, it's kind of a long story. Anyway, no, Dr. Duke's not here. Though I heard the Mad Chef was around someplace, helping with the catering, I think."
"Time's up,"
Griffin said suddenly, causing a few people near the front of the pack to jump until they realized he wasn't talking to anyone who was actually there. "Is Kimball still faffing around? Then he's sacked." Scowling, he turned and said, "Well, that was special. Utina, I've just fired my fifth straight IPSF fleet commander, and I need someone to take point on this joint task force. You in?" Utina grinned. "Do you even have to ask?" "Man's idea of a quick force response is measured in hours," Griffin grumbled. "What, does he think starships have to wait in port until they have steam up on all their boilers?" Utina shook her head and flipped open her communicator.
"Fleetcom, this is Commodore Tencho," she said. "Looks like I'm in charge again for the moment. What have you got for me?"
Alongside her, despite all the stress of the day, Corwin, much less debonair now, in jeans, jump boots, and a dark blue wool shirt, smiled privately at the sight of Anthe deftly swapping out the rank insignia on Utina's jacket, despite the fact that Utina was wearing it, walking, and talking to Fleetcom at the time. Seconds later, they emerged from the long access corridor into the IPO staging area, a large, auditorium-like briefing room in the Blue 3 office complex. The holo displays at the front of the room were already displaying maps representing Fleet Intelligence's best estimates of the situation in the Tau Ceti system, as well as lists of probable assets available for the counterstrike. As she reached the front of the room, Utina put her communicator away and switched on the comm panel on the lectern instead.
"Am I on?"
she asked.
"Go ahead, Commodore,"
came back the voice of Challenger Comm Operator Hoshi Sato.
"Okay. The code name for this operation is..."
She glanced down at the lectern display.
"Trident.
The strike force will have three core elements.
Group Red will assemble here at Babylon 6 and transit via Metaspace to the initial point at the trailing edge of the Tau Ceti heliopause, here. Blue Group and Gray Group will rendezvous with Red at that point. The flag for this operation will be IPS Valiant. Once we're all together, but in any case, no later than 0200 Avalon time tomorrow, we're all going in. The Space Strike Force's main goal will not be to defeat all the Earth Force assets in the Tau Ceti system. The objective is to get past them long enough to insert a surface force into the capital, Tau Ceti, on Tau Ceti 4, and then keep them busy so they can't launch any orbital strikes on that surface force. She tabbed a control, swapping the center screen's map of the Tau Ceti system for a diagram of the streets of Tau Ceti. Once on the ground, the surface element's primary objective is to recapture Government House, here, from Earth Force, determine the status of President Charles Callan, and hopefully restore him to office. Secondary objectives will be to secure the headquarters of the Tau Ceti Constabulary, here, and the Republic of Tau Ceti Defense Force, here. Hopefully we'll be able to help the cops and the TCDF get back on their feet and in the fight. Intel on the ground situation is all but non-existent right now, but it's likely that by the time we get there, they'll be pretty well pinned down or in the bag. Questions? Jay McCandless put up a hand. You're kidding me with a hand up, aren't you, Jay? Utina asked, cracking her first smile since being swept into command of the crisis. Sorry, said McCandless, returning the grin for an instant before becoming all business once more. Force of habit. What's our approximate strength, space and ground assets, do we know yet? It's a little sketchy, since we're pulling the thing together in such a hurry. Right now it looks like Group Red will be Valiant, Challenger, Hoskage, the private starships Kurotai and Gravy Train, the Gamelon Crown starship Lorica, and HMS Illustrious of the Imperial Seleucian Guards. Blue Group will be an ad hoc task force from the Wedge Defense Force Strategic Fleet, I don't have a list yet, and Gray Group will be whatever IPSF assets are within sprinting distance of the IP. Again, not sure who that'll be yet. What about the free spaces? Asked Boba Fett. They're mostly to hell and gone on the far side of Enigma right now, Utrina said. Aya Nakajima will probably make it to the IP in time to be in on the strike, assuming she doesn't blow a warp stack cap trying. That got a laugh out of those in the room who knew Aya. As for ground forces, a lot of that depends on who makes it to the rendezvous from Gray and Blue groups. Some of the IPSF ships may have TACDIV action teams aboard, and most WDF Strat Fleet ships carry a couple dozen Marines. Apart from that, and the ODSTs in Illustrious, it's pretty much what you see in this room. Pete Stacker stood up, looked slowly around, and considered. So, a bunch of duelists, a TACDIV SMF, a White Legion Special Assault Squad, two Jedi Knights, a Gamelon Princess, a handful of Romulan Gamelon Guards, the suspicious-looking group of women in identical black armor, three Aegis Ops, three superheroes from New Avalon, a couple experts of justice, a Spartan, and whatever the hell crazy shit Cajun Barlow are. Stacker looked up at the back of the room as a late-arriving group filed in, took his best guess based on what their uniforms looked like, and added without missing a beat, and a Roman Legion. Then, shaking his head with a smile, he sat back down and said, "Damn, I feel bad for these Earth Force pukes." Up in the back corner of the room, one of the wedding guests approached Griffin and said in a quiet voice, "I understand that you can't have one of our warships involved in this operation. Since we're not part of the Tau Ceti Defense Pact, it wouldn't be politically expedient. But if I just happened to just accidentally wander aboard the Valiant, do you think you could find a place for me?" Griffin smiled guardedly, hands folded behind his back, and did not quite look directly at Corwin's old playmate Achika Shannon, Princess Achika of Jirai, as he replied, "Commodore Tenjo is in command of this operation, Your Highness. Any action that might result from your turning up in the combat zone would be up to her. Given the broad authority that task force commanders have in open crisis situations, you would probably find yourself conscripted for the duration." Achika didn't smile directly at him either, as she said to no one in particular, "Excellent." Then, briefly touching his arm, she turned and walked away to join the others. "As for the expected opposition," Utrina went on, "we're still putting that together, too." Consulting the lectern display again, she added,
Our friends in the Royal Seleucian Navy have one of their U-ships in the system, HMS Unfathomable, nice name, and they're in the process of gathering intel on the Earth Force Strike Group now. They'll have a report for us when we reach the IP.
Anything else?
No one had anything else.
Okay, said Utna. Now we just have to figure out how to get everybody here onto the ships we have available. Corbin, I think you should bring Dagger Disk. We may need her to put part of the surface element down if they're jamming transporters, and you never know when we might have to knock a really large hole in something.
Roger that, Corbin replied, grinning.
It's too bad Dagger Disk doesn't have a big enough space fold wake to move Red Group, said Nall a tad wistfully.
They'd know we were out there for sure if we did that anyway, said Corwin. Reflex spacefold isn't exactly a subtle way to travel.
We have space for a dozen or so, Liza spoke up.
Lorica has room for perhaps 50, Amanda added. She carries a much smaller crew now than she was originally built for.
Utna nodded. Okay, Repo Men, SAS 779, you're with us on the Valiant. Everyone else can go in Challenger and Illustrious. Move out, people. We're burning daylight.
As the room started emptying, Utna watched them go and felt a deep satisfaction. Okay, it wasn't the complicated operation she'd expected to spend the day carrying out, but on the other hand, she was, however unexpectedly, in charge of this one. It felt good. Getting back in the saddle always did.
Climbing the stairs to the back of the room, she was met by one of the people Stacker had spotted entering at the end of his rundown. Utna had no idea who they were. Their uniforms were entirely unfamiliar, and she'd half assumed they were some IPO special unit she hadn't heard of before. They really did look like some kind of modern-day Roman soldiers. The person approaching her now wore segmented armor of golden metal over a padded scarlet bodysuit similar to that worn under a tactive frame, a high-tech Roman-style helmet with a scarlet brush on top, and carried on her back a large curved shield by a heavy leather strap. As she approached, she took off her helmet, tucked it into the crook of her left arm, and came to attention, saluting with her right hand straight out in front of her, palm down.
"Hail, Commodore," she said. "I am Praefectus Flavius Sartori of the 66th Legion. My Lord Legatus Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa bids me place myself and my detachment at your service in the coming battle."
Utna blinked. "You are a Roman Legion? Wait a minute, you're Seleucian."
Flavius smiled. "We are Einherjar," she said. "Though we have not permanently exercised our right of return, we all hold it. And the Allfather sent us to serve your Aunt Bertandia as ushers and guards for your wedding." Looking genuinely contrite, she added, "I regret that I cannot place the entire 66th at your disposal. I have with me only Century 2 of the 10th Cohort, the Legion's Scout Century, but you will find us equal to any challenge. Even without our repulsor steeds, we are a swift and agile force, adept at fighting on the move. We will suit your own style of battle well."
Utna blinked a couple of times, processing this new information, then nodded. "I'll take all the help I can get," she said, shaking Flavia's hand. "100 of you, huh? 10 to Challenger."
"Go ahead, Commodore," replied the voice of Lor Soong.
"Can you make temporary room for 100 people?"
Tricky. We just finished making space for the rest of the Valkyrie and their gear."
"We require little space," Flavius said. "We have only the equipment we carry, and we're accustomed to hard marches. Any room large enough for us to stand up in will do."
"Lor, did you get that?"
"Yep. Simplifies things. I can put them on the main hangar deck if they don't mind the slight risk of depressurization," he added, apparently serious. "The old Klingon marine trick."
"We've had worse," Flavius said.
"Okay, we'll get ready," Lor said. "We move the shuttles around a little, they'll even have room to sit down."
"You spoil us with luxury," Flavia told him, and though she was smiling, she didn't seem to be indulging in sarcasm. Then, saluting Utna again, she said, "We'll go prepare. I look forward to fighting alongside you, Commodore."
Utna was still mulling that development over. Strange woman, even for an Einherjar soldier, when Corwin matched step with her in the hallway outside.
"Well," she said wryly with a glance at her watch, "this isn't what I figured I'd be doing at this point in the day."
Corwin chuckled. "No kidding," he said.
Listen, I just thought. With Kozue gone, if I'm flying Dagger Disc, who's going to drive the bus for you? Before Utena could reply that she hadn't thought of that, a shortish, slender, gray jumpsuited man with a black buzz cut and a look of faint amusement stepped out of a corridor junction ahead of them and said, "That's a cue if I ever heard one. I think I can help you out with that, kid." Corwin halted, a look of astonishment on his face. Utena stopped too, her train of thought derailed. Why did this man look so familiar? She could swear she knew him from somewhere, and yet she was just as certain that they'd never met.
"Gus?" Corwin blurted.
Then, shaking the man's hand and slapping his back at the same time, he asked happily,
"Jesus, who let you out of your cage?"
"Are you kidding? Miss your wedding?" the man replied. "I heard an INE group was going to come work security, and I thought, that's the place for me this weekend." Then, grinning, he said, "Are you planning to introduce me?" "Oh, sorry, yeah. Utena, I want you to meet an old friend of mine from Valhalla." Then, drawing himself up and putting on his most formal tone, with a slightly ironic smirk, he said, "Commodore Utena Tenjo, International Police Space Force. Lieutenant Colonel Virgil I. Grissom, United States Air Force."
"Oh,"
said Utena as the pieces fell into place. "Call me Gus," said Grissom, shaking her hand with a grin.
"Wow. This is really an honor," Utena said. "I'd seen you in simulations. I should have known you'd be in Valhalla."
"The honor's mine," Grissom said. "I've heard a lot about you. You guys are in a hurry, right? Fill me in as we go. From what Corwin was just saying, it sounded like you need a pilot." It took Utena two doors worth of hallway to give him the short version. Thus informed, Grissom excused himself to make a fast trip to the quartermaster's on his way to his new duty station. Different groups of erstwhile wedding guests peeled away from the mass as it advanced, heading off down side hallways to different transporter rooms or to collect some last-minute equipment, until finally only Utena, Kate, Corwin, Nall, Anthy, and Corwin's two new robot friends remained. "Guess I better get headed down to the hangar deck," Corwin observed as they approached the door to Transporter Room 1. "See you guys at the IP." The transporter room door opened. "A moment, grandson," said the person who emerged. Corwin's eyebrows went up in surprise. Since she had been thwarted by exigency in her aim of conducting his wedding ceremony, he had expected his grandmother would have left the station by now, returning to Asgard with the other Aesir, but no. It was very rare for anyone outside Gladsheim, the great hall of government at the center of the city of Asgard, to even see the Queen of the Aesir these days. Since the thwarted Ragnarok, she had held herself largely aloof from the politics and daily dealings of the gods, immersing herself in the greater mysteries of the universe and seeking the true meaning of the Ragnarok's failure. She was reputed to be a seeress of great power and skill, and even in Asgard, such a reputation will tend to set a woman apart. Frigg was a tall and regal woman, even by the standards of her tall and regal people, and she did not look even a fraction of her immense age. The only outward signs she bore of her long years were the steel-gray color of her tightly plaited hair and some fine lines at the corners of eyes and mouth. She held herself very upright and wore her voluminous robes with an easy grace. Though adorned with a great weight in gold and jewelry, she yet wore a plain white kerchief upon her head, after a fashion long since abandoned by younger wives even in Asgard. Corwin could still remember the first time Nall had ever seen her, years before, when they were both children visiting his grandfather's palace in Asgard. Frigg had appeared to them briefly, passing from one place to another on some inscrutable private errand. She had greeted them warmly enough, bade them go in peace, and vanished into another part of the palace.
"That's your grandmother?" Nall had inquired.
"Well, yeah, what of it?"
Nothing. I guess I just expected someone a little more matronly. You know, based on the lore."
"Well, based on the lore, Aunt Erd is a withered crone."
"Point."
For his part, Corwin had never found her all that intimidating. She was a bit odd, to be sure, but there were plenty of odd people in Asgard, and besides, she was his grandmother. He couldn't be sure, but there were times when he suspected that she had a particular fondness for him, moments when she showed him special favor, flashes of warmth and kindness that, while always cordial, she did not commonly show others. Now she gave him a private smile as she stepped into the corridor before the small group and regarded them.
This day was ill-starred, she said, but before some things even the gods stand powerless. It cannot be helped.
I'm sorry to have brought you all this way for nothing, Grandmother, Corwin said. When the situation is resolved... Freak nodded.
As I said, it cannot be helped. And when this crisis is over, perhaps we will be able to try again, all of us.
Here she gave a wry little smile before continuing, in the time before the next crisis arises.
In the meantime, though, there is a matter that is of great concern to me.
What is it, Grandmother?
The two of you are going off to war. There is a chance, however small, that either or both of you may not return. Though we haven't time to do the thing properly, I would not see you go with swords unexchanged.
Corwin, understanding the reasons for his grandmother's request at once, bowed his head.
As you wish, he said.
Utna considered protesting that they didn't have time for that either, but even she hesitated to say no to a heartfelt request by the All-Mother. Instead, she echoed Corwin's gesture. Frigg gave them another slight smile.
Fear not, she said, and with a small gesture she caused Utrina's wedding crown to reappear upon her head. An old woman's fancy shan't delay you long.
Reddening slightly, Utrina unbuckled the sword belt she wore, gathered it about the scabbard of her new sword, turned, and offered the whole assemblage to Corwin, while Caitlin and Nall looked on in something very like awe, and Anthea observed with a calmly beaming smile. Behind them, Wally turned in some puzzlement to his companion and asked quietly,
"Eva?"
"Shh," Eve replied in a low voice, without taking her rapt attention from the scene unfolding before them.
"Important."
Utna had prepared a little speech for this bit of the actual ceremony, of course. Even under these strange circumstances, her extra work with Vigdis the day before told through. The word sprang to her mind at once.
"This sword is Ragnildr, from the forge of Dan and Ironbridge," she said. "My hands helped shape her. My eye has made her true. My blood has made her strong. So long as my neck does not bend to tyranny, nor shall she. So long as my love for you does not dull, nor shall she. So long as my heart does not break, nor shall she. Before these witnesses I present her now to you."
She hesitated for the barest instant, not reluctant to say the next words, but still faintly incredulous that she was saying them.
"My husband."
Smiling, Corwin accepted the blade, buckled it on, and removed his own. Next to the gleaming newness of Ragnildr's haft and scabbard, the sword Corwin presented in turn looked a trifle shabby, with its plain black leather grip, simple cross-hilt and round pommel, its scabbard worn with many years of hard use.
"This sword," he said, "is one of three made by Ivaldi the Ancient, most legendary smith in all the heavens, for the three sons of Bor, Odin, Vili, and Ve. This one belonged to Vili the Strong until his death, eons ago in the great battle of Valgatr. Since then she has passed through many hands and been known by many names. Having sought her throughout the nine worlds, I have reclaimed her for the House of Odin. Before these witnesses, I entrust her now to you, my wife." Utrin took the ancient blade, regarded it for a moment with a look of wonder, then belted it on, and took both of Corwin's hands in hers.
"Ah,"
murmured Wally in an "I get it now" tone, reaching up to interlock his fingers with Eve's.
"Before these witnesses, my blessing upon you both," Frigg said softly. "Go now. I've delayed you long enough."
Smiling slightly once more, she added, "We can conclude the formalities another time." For a few long seconds, Corwin and Utna gazed at each other while Caitlin wiped away tears with a handkerchief offered by a smiling Anthe. Then Corwin cracked a grin, breaking the silent spell that had held them both. "You're not changing your name, right? 'Cause I gotta say," he said, brushing a hand through her long pink hair, "that'd be a bit silly, considering." Utna laughed, drawing him into a readily returned, crushing hug, then gave him a fierce but brief kiss before tearing herself regretfully away. "Maybe you should change yours," she quipped, then called back over her shoulder as she entered the transporter room.
See you at the IP, Corwin. Kate paused to give her brother a hug of her own, congratulated him, and went through the doors as well. Anthy's hug was not as crushing as Utrina's, nor her kiss as fierce, but the merriment and pride in her eyes said all she needed to say.
Great job, Nall said, his usual smartassery wiped away by the moment. I'm going to run down and warm up the disk.
After they were all gone, and only he and the two robots remained, Corwin turned to Frigg, bowed, and said,
Thank you, Grandmother.
Thank you, Grandson, for humoring me, Frigg replied.
Even though time is so short, I almost feel like we should have said more, Corwin confessed, rubbing at the back of his neck.
Frigg merely chuckled indulgently.
You said everything that needed saying years ago, Grandson, in a place called the Monolith.
At his look of surprise, she laughed and added,
Oh yes, I heard you.
You spoke with such passion, such truth. How could I not?
I never have explained to your grandfather why he came home to find me weeping that day.
Corwin blinked, then did the only thing he could think of under the circumstances, bowed and thanked her again.
Go, Frigg replied, touching his shoulder. Uphold your oath, young cavalier.
Grinning, Corwin saluted, turned, and ran toward the side corridor to the hangar bay service lift, gesturing for Wally and Eve to follow him. They were about halfway down in the service lift when Corwin's handling trilled for his attention.
Yeah, Nall.
I think we have a little problem here.
Corwin's smile slipped away, replaced by a look of mingled resignation and annoyance.
Ymir's bones, now what?
You'll see in a minute. Just get down here.
Before Corwin could ask for more illumination, Nall clicked off. The young god finished the elevator ride with a sense of deep impatience, then darted down the corridor and around the corner into the hangar bay.
Okay, Nall, what's so...
Corwin skidded to a halt so suddenly that Eve and Wally almost collided with him from behind. Eve zigged, Wally zagged, and they ended up flanking him instead, all three standing in a line abreast and gazing with dismay at the scene before them. Nall was sprawled on his back, hands raised by his head in surrender as the point of a long, cruelly curved sword just touched the skin of his throat. Reading the situation in a nanosecond, Eve went immediately to combat mode, eyes narrowed, her cannon arm up and ready. The red dot of her laser sight flicked on, resting unwaveringly in the precise center of the space between the two sharply angled muspel brands on Nanami Kiryu's forehead.
Hello, Corwin, said Nanami with a smile.
This concludes Symphony 5, Movement 2, Clarion Call. The symphony will return in A Song of War.